last set, and then we're going to dive into an exercise here in class. So in the PDF that is on the site, the heuristics factors that are on the readings page, this is what I want you to use this document for your homework this week. There are two factor sets in here. You get to choose which one you want to use. What we might do is talk about them in class and come to consensus about which set to use as a class, just because of the way the assignment works. But there are two different factor sets here, and how we use them varies a little bit in terms of what we want to answer and how we want to approach the documentation and our recommendations to a particular client. So when we're doing a review, there's usually more than just the heuristics, more than just we look at the site and say, well, this is crappy, this is crappy, this is crappy. That's not so crappy, this is crappy, this is crappy. There's a variety of things. So one of them is the heuristics analysis. We look at how well things are working based on existing standards, guidelines, best practices, our experience as designers. I do want to remind you that when we do a heuristics analysis, we are looking for both strengths and weaknesses. We want to know what is the site doing well and what is the site doing poorly. Most of the time when we're asked to do a review on a site, the emphasis is going to be on what is wrong. So the bulk of what we identify in the report tends to be the weaknesses. However, when you come across something in a site that is being done well, either it's a great example of best practices, or it is standards compliant, or it simply works well for that user base, it is important to call out the successes of an existing site or product. People, you know, we're still human. Think about your own feelings, right? If someone's analyzing something you've done and you get a 50-page report from them on everything that is wrong, by the time you get to the end of that report, you feel demoralized, right? Like, why do I even bother? And we know that some things do work and that some things are good, and so we want to be able to leverage the strengths that are there. So it's important to acknowledge when something is done well, because we don't necessarily want to redesign it into something that's going to be worse than the existing solution. So calling out the strengths is not only good for the person reading the report who already owns the site, but is a reminder for ourselves, be careful tweaking this, it's already working well. So it may be something to leverage in the designs moving forward. It's not something we have to resolve, right? It's already working. Don't waste your time on it or tweak it minimally. We also often include a style compliance review. This is about consistency. It might be brand consistency, design consistency, voice and content consistency. But we're really looking at the tone and the voice and the appearance of the site. I commented earlier about older sites, older products over time with different teams, their voice becomes fragmented, their style becomes fragmented. And it introduces visual inconsistencies to it, or content inconsistencies. It may not break the functionality of the site, it may still work fine, but they are inconsistencies nonetheless. And these might be little things, you know, like inconsistent typography in header size and font face. Or different color values on primary action buttons. Like, it's usually orange, but every so often there's a red button. Why? You know, how did those handful of red buttons slip in? Does it mean something? One thing to keep in mind from the user's perspective is whenever they see something that's a little bit out of place, they try to attribute meaning to the difference, right? So if 90% of the buttons are orange, the primary action buttons are orange, and then 1 out of 10 is red, people are going to stop and think, why is this one red? Does that mean something? Is red different? No. Red was the color that designer liked. Everything else was orange because it was done in the previous effort. Right? It doesn't mean anything, but people will often try to attribute meaning to differences. So we look at style, compliance, and consistency. And then verification and validation review. Does it actually work as intended? So when you are doing a heuristics analysis, you often come across code failures, right? You get a 404 error, you get JavaScript that doesn't do what it's supposed to, you see a little inline error from the database, some little MySQL, you know, table has a glitch in it, and a snippet of code appears into the page, stuff like that. Or you can generate errors by putting in fake data. So you put your name into a zip code field to see whether or not it catches it, and what error code does it generate, or what error message does it generate. If it allows you to submit that, it's a problem. What's your zip code? David. And it takes it? That's going to be a problem on the fulfillment end, right? It's like, no, this is not a valid zip code. The system should have caught that. So we try to break things to see what the error messages are, and we keep our eyes open for things that break on their own without any particular concerted effort on our part. I tried to go into the blog and something was wrong because it was only showing me the one recent blog post and all the archives are empty, right? Yet you tell me that you've been writing on the blog for years and have hundreds of posts. There's something is glitched out. So we look for mistakes, we look for errors. So it's not just the information and interaction design, but it's also the voice and the appearance, and it's also how well it works and how well it handles errors. So we try to break it, we look for consistency, we try to make sure everything works well. Now, when we're focused on the heuristics analysis, that's what these factor sets are for. In this first factor set, they're divided into groups. So we have user experience factors, design factors, visual information and interaction design, and we have content factors, and then we have errors. So I'm not going to read into detail in each of these, but you can see things like under user experience factors, we've grouped up here what are essentially Nielsen's, modified slightly, but Nielsen's criteria. Visitor control and freedom, correspondence with visitor experience, minimizing cognitive load, flexibility and efficiency, and then there are examples under each. Like, what do we really mean? When we talk about minimizing cognitive load, what are some things that do that for people? Well, forward paths and navigations options are findable and visible. In other words, on every page, can I see where I can go from here? Or on every screen, am I able to predict where I could go from here? Back paths or navigations are findable and visible. Is there a return? Is there back? Is there a breadcrumb? Do I have persistent access to navigation? Stuff like that. Lateral paths, in other words, you know, like hyperlinking or jumping from section header or section overview to section overview, are they visible? Are the instructions findable and visible? Is necessary information presented without relying on visitor memory? Right, so when we were talking earlier about Allison's design, where I said, when I change my slider and it changes my flight, how do I compare that to the flight that was there before? How do I know what was changed? And we said, well, that introduces cognitive friction because it forces a person to remember information that is no longer in front of them. So that would be a violation here of minimizing cognitive load. Does it carry necessary information forward through successive steps? When I was asking Lisa, where am I building my itinerary? And it was building, but I looked right over it because I thought it was a block of instructional text. So in this particular case, it did carry the information forward, but it didn't put it in a place where either I was prone to see it or expected to see it or would pause to see it. So we would think about, how can I make sure it's in like the scanning path for the person and highlighted in some way? So when we take a look at design, consistency and standards, aesthetics, minimalism, reducing redundancy, and once again, a whole series of examples. This first set, then we can rate in different ways. Like if we find a problem and we classify it, not picking on Allison, but let's say we have this, we've identified a problem. There's one flight, and when it changes, I don't have comparison to the previous flights, so we're not carrying it forward. I can rate it a couple different ways. I can just give it a qualitative rating and a number. It's a poor experience, right? It's not failing, it's not breaking the experience, but it's making it harder for the person. A weak, difficult to learn or find, confusing, occasional errors, partially functional. So I'd give that a score of 1, a rating of poor. Or we can also talk about things like how often does it happen, what's the impact, and the likelihood of encountering it on subsequent visits. So there are different ways we can frame the errors. I'm likely, in Allison's case, to use this first rating scale because I'm not talking about a software application. I'm not talking about a site that I'm going to come back to a few times a week, every week, for months on end. I'm probably going to come to it a few times once to plan a vacation, and then I'm done and not come back to it again. On the other hand, if we're talking about a web application or desktop software, talking about how many people are affected, what's the impact or the severity of that problem, and what's the likelihood that I'm going to encounter it on subsequent visits, now I might use this way of rating it. So if I'm trying to rate something like how well PowerPoint works, right? So I'm using PowerPoint, unfortunately, more than I want to, but I'm in PowerPoint 10 times a week. So if I have a particular error, it's affecting 80% of the people or 80% of my visits. Is it impacting things? Well, it's not crashing my files or making things, you know, bad, but I keep having to fix alignment or transitions or something like that. So the impact is moderate. Persistence, likelihood of encountering it, fairly high because it's an action that I do repeatedly. So I'm bound to run into it again and again. So that is another way of thinking about the errors that we encounter. Generally, I think people prefer using this type of a rating scale. What's the severity of the problem? Rather than getting into this depth of how often does it occur, how severe is it, and what's the likelihood of encountering it again? It's just been my experience. We very rarely use this. The other set of factors that we have here, factor set two, you'll see this is the factor set that's used in the example documents that we're going to show in a moment. So I've got two sample heuristics reviews that I'll show you. They're looking for similar things, but they're grouped in very different ways. So number one, we're looking at the organization of the site. Is it organized, or application? Is it organized in a logical, meaningful way that makes sense to people? They just understand how to move through it, how to find things. And once again, a whole bunch of questions that we can ask. Does it have purposeful, natural, and logical organization? Are unrelated items differentiated? Are interface behaviors consistent across the site? So we've got a bunch of criteria that we can look for. Simplicity, right? The extraneous. Is it more complex than it needs to be? Did we make it harder than it should have been? Einstein once said that you should. How do they say it exactly? Something, use the simplest solution, but none simpler, kind of thing. I'm going to have to look that up now because I totally botched up the quotation, but it ends with not simpler. but the simplicity issue. Visibility, once again, and we've said this in here a million times, visibility always wins, right? When people see what they want, it's a successful experience for them. The challenge is that different people want different things at different times, and we can't make everything visible. But are all of the important things visible? There are certain things you should never hide, right? Like, don't hide the navigational system on a website and make people go searching for it. We showed that Triaminic website where the nav was in that little, this was in the previous class, the nav was in like a little button. It said, you know, open here to see the navigation, or open here to see the menu, and people were like, menu for what? And you open it up and you realize it's the nav to the site. Efficiency. Are we doing work for people? Are we offloading the effort for them? Are we remembering things for them? Are we saving data for them? Are we providing them information that they need when they need it? So are we facilitating their experience? Feedback. Feedback and tolerance, number six, have a bit of overlap with errors, right? So feedback, do I know where I am? But if there are errors, am I providing information to resolve them? Tolerance. I like the phrase tolerance here because people are error prone, and we will try to put in the same information in multiple ways. And an example that we use in these classes that's a really great example is just putting your phone number in on a website, right? All the digits, dashes between them, periods between them, use parentheses and a space. A lot of ways that I can put it in. If it's a really smart system, it doesn't matter, right? As long as I've got 10 digits, I'll format it however I want for the database. If it's a stupid system, it's going to tell you exactly how to type it and generate an error if you don't match their pattern. So that has very low tolerance for user input. Whereas putting it in however you want and I'll extract the 10 digits has very high tolerance. We want systems that have very high tolerance. They can fix our mistakes for us without telling us that we made an error. And when we do make an error, they understand why and can recommend a solution. But it's also things like undo and redo. And I like this last one, actually. Interpret reasonable actions reasonably. Remember that people are not computers, and their expectations of what the computer should do are based on their context and on their needs. And we need to think, you know, they are not thinking like the developer who wrote the code. They are thinking like the person who's trying to figure out how to get a dog license from, you know, the animal control board. And so understanding that the drive, the motivation, the expectations, and what they predict will happen helps us to understand how to respond to their inputs or to their queries. Credibility. We talked a little bit about this in the previous class. We mentioned there's some work being done down at Stanford University by BJ Fogg a few years ago. He has since shifted on into other areas, but he started the Web Credibility Project. And one of the things about the Web Credibility Project is that the quality of the design actually changes people's perceptions of the credibility of the brand or of the site. So you may go to a perfectly credible site, but if the quality of the design is poor and it feels like someone's trying to rip you off, then they're not going to trust that site. And it can work the other direction as well, right? You go to a site that looks perfectly trustworthy, it's got nice design, and it's more likely to rip you off because you trust it based on the quality of the design. So that's one of the things that we can look for in terms of credibility, is the quality of the design. But there are other things as well, like, are there explicit privacy policies? Is it called out somewhere? A great example of that is when you're signing up and you have to put in your name and your email address, and there's the little disclaimer of how we use this or why are we asking for this. And if that little link is there and you click it and it opens up and it says, we never sell or give away your email address to anyone for any reason, right? And it's written in plain English, you trust it. It's like, oh, they know. So thinking about tolerance and reasonable actions reasonably, the language that is there, they know that people don't want to read legalese. They know that people want to be reassured that we are not going to spam them. And so the answer that they give is basically, we don't do anything with your email address. It's just so that we can contact you. And a lot of them even today go further to say, and you can control how often and when we contact you, right? Because you go into your account and there's a whole set of controls. So unfortunately, newsletter spam is still a big issue for a lot of people in email, but sites who are doing better at that are allowing you to do things like very specifically say, which emails do you want to subscribe to based on topic? And they've even started to add things like changing the frequency of the email. So would you like to get email from us, but not as often? Because that's really why most people are saying unsubscribe me. You know, 5 Groupons a day, don't want it. Groupon Digest on Monday morning, maybe I'm interested. So if I can control the type of content and the frequency of the content, I am more likely to be to maintain contact with you as a brand or as a site. So that contributes to credibility. But other things, like looking at the code, is it a table-based layout? Well, that's kind of ancient, isn't it? And so that can affect credibility for the people who are technically oriented. Using encrypted connections when they're collecting like payment information, is the little lock in the HTTPS up in the address bar. So is it secure when important information is being transmitted? Lends to a sense of credibility. Number 8 is an optional one. We don't need to do it in this class because accessibility is a huge topic, but accessibility refers to the availability of the content and functionality on the site to the disabled. And there's been a really, really changing world over the past several years, because a lot of the lawsuits that are brought up under the Americans with Disabilities Act, not under technology regulations. So basically people are saying that websites are like physical accommodations. You need to be available to everyone. So there's a lot of guidelines, there's a lot of legal limbo around things as well. So we're not going to get too deep into that one, but some of you may be faced with the need for dealing with accessibility at a much stricter level. And there's a lot of content, a lot of books and experts out there. And once again, we can rate these.
Is it what about like internationalization?
Good question. So Sean's asking, where does internationalization fall? We don't need to create a separate category for that. We could if we were doing an analysis, like what's going to be different. When we talk about internationalization, there's a few questions that we need to ask first. Like, is it going to be the same site, basically the same site delivered in multiple countries and languages? And if so, then we do it differently. Then are we going to have multiple sites? Will they be different sites? Because if they're different sites, then we analyze each site separately, right, in the context of that country. Mm-hmm. If it's one site that we're trying to template and then swap out the content and the language that is in it, then we'll probably evaluate it as a single site. But then we're going to take a look at things like, for example, does anything change in these first five areas? So normally a lot of the issues that pop up around internationalization pop up in the first four or five areas, so it kind of spreads throughout. It's a good question though, because a lot of times when we're doing these studies, we're typically limited to just one site. You know, what is it for our North American site, or something like that.
When you guys did that, what's that cosmetic site?
Benefit.
Here we go. Did you guys go through this? Like for the Chinese site, all that?
No, we didn't. We actually didn't have to do a heuristics analysis on the existing site because they were replacing all of their sites. It was a complete re-platform, new backend technology, new design. They just threw away the old stuff. They flipped the switch, the old site died, and the new ones went live. But there were three separate sites, South Korea, China, and North America. Yeah. They have slightly different product catalogs. They have some shared content, but they actually have some fairly different design elements because of cultural expectations and differences. Okay. Yeah, so those were different sites. We did not do an analysis on the existing site. So let's just take a quick look at these and get a sense of which set you think you might prefer to work from. And let me show you some examples also. So here, this is an older one from Sanrio. I don't remember the date, probably back around 2005. You know, the Hello Kitty people. So the set of, let's see, do we have them in here? No, we don't. Okay, so I don't have the criteria set that we used here. There's a methodology list. And then when we do a heuristics eval, we always pull out what are the key things that we're going to recommend, and we put them like in an executive summary at the start. Because the documents tend to be fairly long and the clients don't read every word of it, so we go through and we sift, all right, here's the top 10 things we need to address, or here are the top three or the top five issues in each of the following categories. So that's what this executive summary is at the beginning. There were also a few sites that we looked at. So there's a few things that we've got going on here. This is their old site. We highlight an area and we have an annotation number for it. And then we have a description. And then we also have a recommendation and a priority. So here's the problem. Here's what we recommend for resolving it. And here's the priority that we would assign to this problem. As we go through this site, you'll see there's a lot of red color-coded. High, medium, low, you'll see a lot of red. There were lots of issues on this site. But periodically, and we also color-coded the yellow fill, right? So you can probably barely tell, but intense yellow were high priority fixes, medium yellow, and light yellow. I don't think it's coming across so much. They're just all sort of shades of greenish-gray on the projector. High, 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 high. We're hitting all of the key touch points in the customer experience. Oh, good. There we go. Periodically in there, we identify something that's working well, and here we've got one. So number three, there. It is good to show both the original price and the sale price to educate the customer about the potential savings. Consider adding a percent savings column to increase the appeal of the price reduction and create the perception of substantial savings. So something that they were doing good, minor recommendation that was low priority. It's not going to make a huge change to the customer experience, right? It's just a minor content addition. But we did want to call out that there are some occasional strengths here. Moderate, moderate. Not many goods, huh?
Depressing.
Oh, good. Oh. There you go. So there's another one. So you can see there's a handful of them scattered throughout. And these PDFs are on the wiki, so you can take a look at these in more detail. Here's another one. This is Design Within Reach. This is a newer one that we did. So once again, the methodology, but here's the factor set that we use. This is factor set 2 that we just reviewed.
I noticed you changed the keys. Hmm.
Yeah, made good more readable. Yeah, white on green instead of green on white. Minor design changes happen over time.
But I mean, I was.
And we got rid of the background fill also. There's also more detail in this one. So how does this work? What's the factor set that we use? What's the rating scale? Why are we doing this? What are the brand ideals? Remember that whole consistency review thing, the style and compliance review? Which pages did we look at on your site? So we don't look at everything. There's a selected set of pages on the site. Key recommendations, then we used our old logo for identifying the top things in each category. So for the product detail page, the cart, checkout process, and there were a few other pages they wanted us to look at. And then we dive in, same thing. We highlight an area, and then we've got organization, visibility, feedback, and credibility. So here, we're taking a slightly different approach. We're saying, here are organizational issues on the page. Visibility issues on the page, feedback issues on the page, credibility issues on the page. And we can identify if it's good or a high priority problem. So something they're doing well. The page layout grid is strong and consistent. The design embodies key characteristics of modernism, clarity, simplicity, and utility. Those were words that were in their brand ideals. So the grid layout works for them. It is very consistent with their voice. On the other hand, there were some serious problems, like the fact that their primary shopping navigation was concealed within that little area at the top, and that this red V icon was not perceived by people as a way to open that drawer because it was on the left-hand side. People thought it was a V, not an arrow, and they didn't know why there was a V on the DWR site. So things that were problematic that were called out. We've also added, it was very important for them to understand things like, where's the fold line? So we started to mark off things like that so that they would know what's visible on page load.
So I forgot to ask one more thing. Where does responsive design fall?
It isn't in the list at this point in time. Okay. It falls under the general technology. So we said the three components of review, it falls under the technology end.
Okay. But it will be a very important review.
We'll
section,
start
right?
adding it when we start to see more responsive sites. At this point in time, the vast majority of sites still are not responsive. Mm-hmm. So we just make a little note, not responsive.
Okay.
Because there's nothing else we can analyze. But if we're looking at a responsive site, then we need to test the functionality. Are the breakpoints actually logical? Does it respond to a device orientation change? Does the layout break at any point for these different screen sizes? You know, like once we go beyond 1280, does it continue to scale untenably so that you can't read across the page anymore, or does it eventually hit a fixed width that floats, you know, stuff like that. But it would fall into the technology review, not into the heuristics factors.
Oh.
It's one of the code bits. So we would only note it in the heuristics if the code was doing something that broke the experience. But same thing, we're just calling out the areas, we're tagging them. This one, we've evolved in the direction of this because we found that it was easier for people to understand when we had groups of things. Organization problems, simplicity problems, visibility problems, feedback problems, efficiency. And we listed out what the problems were within. Like there is two feedback problems, but one organization, one simplicity, one velocity, or visibility, one efficiency. But grouping them this way made it much easier for people to understand the report. They got to a page and they could go right to a simplicity thing. It's like, oh, what are the complexity issues on this page? What are the simplicity problems? So it was just reorganized to make it easier for them. periodically I'm looking for, in this one, we also have a few cases where we will actually make a visual recommendation, not just a verbal descriptive recommendation on how to fix it, but we'll actually include a little like wireframe segment, because it's just easier to visually say, this could be done better in a different way. And I thought there was an example in here of that. So I'm zooming down real fast because I could have sworn there was. Did one go by, a little wireframe snippet that was on this half of the page?
Oh, no, not half of it.
I've seen some little, these are our little like outtakes of content from the pages, but I thought I had an example one in here where there was actually a little wireframe snippet.
Did you recommend they lower their prices?
actually, one of the things I jokingly said while working the whole time I was working with them is design within reach, within whose reach? lamps for $1,400 instead of $14,000, I guess, makes them marginally more reachable. Unfortunately, this example doesn't have it. But sometimes it's hard to verbally describe what a solution would be. It's a lot easier to just draw a picture and say, this would work better if you move things around like this. So in the recommendations, we might include a little wireframe snippet right in here that says, this is a better, more effective layout, rearrange things like this. Because it's just so much easier to draw that picture than it is to describe something. So you should feel free to be able to do that as well. We try to avoid, in a heuristics report, doing a wireframe, like redoing this whole page in a different wireframe. Because this is not a design project. You know, we're taking a week or two to analyze the analytics, the existing site, take a look at existing research, stuff like that, just to find out, you know, what do we need to address in the design phase. We are not doing this in order to design a specific recommendation. When we do a heuristics review, we're looking at a subset of pages on a site. We're not looking at everything on the site. So we should not be trying to design solutions without the context of the full site, the full project, and all of the information about goals and stuff like that. So if you do make a visual recommendation, a little wireframe recommendation, it's almost always about like how to do one portion of the page a little bit better. Filters could be displayed more effectively if you did it like this, right? Or alternate views are more findable if you position them here. And so we just show a little change, a little snippet, instead of a whole wireframe for the page. Because then clients will look at that and go, oh, wow, you've already done all the work. Thank you. And then you don't have any more work. But you also don't want to solve problems out of context. So don't do the full wireframes here. Okay, so you've seen two examples. I'm going to bias you a little bit and tell you that we very rarely use factor set one anymore. Almost everything that we use for heuristics now are factor set two, the second set. Just from experience, we found that this particular organization of categories, people get, they just understand. Factor set one actually maps to some of the work that Nielsen and others have done around heuristics. It maps more directly to those. But it's also a little bit more abstract, a little bit more conceptual. It feels more technical to clients to break things out this way. And it just hasn't been as effective for us. So I tend to use the second set. I'll recommend, y'all can decide at the end of class, but I'll recommend that for your assignment, you use factor set two as the structure for your heuristics analyses, simply because I think it's a little bit more approachable, it's a little easier, and it tends to be more understandable to clients. Okay, I'm going to leave this set up here for a minute because we're going to flip back and forth. Let me close up these reports. Let's take a look. We've got a few sites here, and we can just take a vote. We've got Abundant Life. There's Nota, it's Navajo, I don't know how to pronounce it. Nota Dine Trading Company and Museum. Cocopelli Bike and Board, Colorado Used Books, City of Ponchatoula, Louisiana, and the Gonzo Inn. we can pick any site, chat amongst yourselves for a moment, and pick the one that we're going to look at for the example here in class. I'll just hum silently the Jeopardy timer song to myself and then ask what you would want. joking? Are you joking? Hello? Okay.
Gonzo.
Everyone goes for Gonzo. It's not even the best one.
Curious.
What is Gonzo?
It's a bed and breakfast. Yeah. Actually, you know what? I'm going to pick one because we've only got half an hour. You could go in and do this one. It has the problems in the Gonzo win are more subtle. We've got half an hour. I want a site that actually is craptacular. So that, so that when we look at it, there's more wrong with it, and it's easier to just sort of identify things, right? Okay, so when you're doing a heuristics review, there are two ways, two approaches that you can take. This is going to be up to you. One way that you could approach it is to look at the site and go, oh, that's bad, right? And then go back to this criterion list and figure which group it's in and why it's bad. So you could go through and you could say, oh, you know, having the navigation only at the bottom of the page, museum, rug story, jewelry, and pottery, that's a bad thing, right? So the navigation is only at the bottom of the page. That's a bad thing. Okay, so I'm pretty sure it's a bad thing. Now, why is it a bad thing? So you come to this page and you're like, all right, is it a visibility problem? Because the navigation options are visible, but they may be below the fold, and so therefore less findable. Is it an organizational problem because things are not placed where people are expecting to find them? Is it a simplicity problem because having them in the wrong place makes it harder or more complex to find them? Or is it an efficiency problem because people actually have to scroll down the page farther to find the navigation? They have to look for it. So maybe it's a cognitive effort thing. So now you've identified a problem, you need to figure out how you want to classify it. And don't be surprised when one problem can be classified in multiple ways. That happens a lot. So I think navigation at the bottom of the page is a great example. Yes, it's a visibility problem, right? They're not visible on page load for people who are on certain browser sizes, or they're just in an unexpected location. We could also say, that interactivity and functionality is appropriate and where visitor expects it or needs it. That's an organizational problem, right? Navigation's at the top of the page. Everyone looks there first, and you have it only at the bottom. So when you have a problem that can be classified in multiple categories, that's okay. Problems are multifaceted. They're not just going to be one thing. So you just pick the category that you think best describes why it's a problem. So in this case, I'm probably not going to go with visibility because this is 1024 by 768. So even at 1024 by 768, they are just visible at the bottom of the page, right? So I don't really have to scroll. They're just kind of in an unexpected location. They're not where people are going to look for them. So I'm more inclined to say that that is an organizational problem because functionality is appropriate, but not where people expect to find it. So it's not where they are looking for it. It would be sort of like, you know, having the shopping cart in the footer instead of in the header. It's on the page, but it's not where people expect it. I'm going to have to go looking for it. So we just classify it then. So if I had a screenshot of this page, I would draw an area around this, tag it, you know. Number one, it's an organizational problem because the navigation, customers expect navigation to be at the header of the page, not at the bottom, potentially below the fold where it is not visible. That's the problem. How do we fix it? It's an easy fix, right? Move the navigation to a more traditional location at the top or left column. And that's all you need to say about it. We don't have to draw the recommendation. We just say move it up or to the left. All right. Another approach that you could take to doing one of these analyses is to say, all right, I'm going to go to this page and I am going to look for feedback errors. So you go into the page saying, I'm going to look for a particular type, and you do that for each one. I go to this page, what are the organizational problems? Check, check, check. What are the simplicity problems? None. Visibility problems? Check. Efficiency problems? Check, check. Feedback? None. Tolerance? The thing's interactive. None. Credibility? Well, it's kind of a cheap looking site. Do I really trust them with my American Express card for a $2,500 rug? Maybe not so much, right? So that's a judgment on the quality, the perception of credibility there. But we can describe why. You know, the visual design does not inspire trust, you're not using encrypted transactions, whatever, but you could call that out. So some people find it easier to go very systematically through a page. What are the organization errors? What are the simplicity errors? What are the visibility errors? And they treat this like as a checklist, and they go through the page 7 or 8 times. Other people, like me, look at the page and just circle stuff. Wrong, 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 wrong. And then take a look at each of the circles. What is the best classification for what I have circled on the page? So you can do it either way, whatever works for you. It's all about your approach and what you feel most comfortable with. That said, because we're going to do like a quick exercise in here, does anyone have laptops with networks? If so, then we can like spread a couple more of these screens around the room if you want. If not, don't worry about it. I can switch back and forth here. But if you've got a laptop and you can pull it up, that'll help you out. We're going to pull up another one of their pages. Let's see how this one is. These are all pretty boring. Content, content, content. More content. Well, let's just go to the homepage. There's enough wrong on the homepage. We've identified just one thing here, the nav. Let's take, 15, 20 minutes just with this portion of the page that is visible now. Identify other potential issues on the design. Right? Like, there are other things that could be improved here. Sometimes a way that you can approach this to try and figure out, like, where are the problem spots is to, when you look at a page, just do like a rough sketch. Like, if I were to rewireframe this, how would I rearrange it? Because a lot of times what you rearrange and how you rearrange it will highlight gaps or extraneous content. Like, you might do a quick little sketch in your head of how to rearrange this and then realize that they are completely missing something that you think is really important. Or you find that the same piece of information occurs 3 times on the page and it's redundant and the content should just be consolidated. And you might not have noticed that if you hadn't done a little sketch. And it's not like you have to do detail, but it's just like, how would I fix it in my head? What did I move? What did I change? That's probably where the problems are. Then you circle it on the original, and then you try to figure out what the problem was, if that's the approach that you're taking. So these are all different ways that you can try and tackle it. The goal, however, is to figure out a way that we can encapsulate, we can report to a client, here are weaknesses in the design. If you see any strengths, keep them. But here are weaknesses in the design. Here are some suggested improvements. This is why they are weaknesses and why they should be addressed. So I'll keep this visible. I can go back and forth between the factor set whenever you need. So you see the factors there. But identify issues with this page. Work in, say, groups of 3 or 4. We've got 3, 3, 4. Same thing again. You're always an odd number of people for us. So groups of 3 or 4. And identify some issues, classify those issues, and at about 15 after or so, because it's a small page, at about a quarter after, we'll just regroup and identify what you've found as problems. Each group will get a couple minutes. Okay, go for it.